for what's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has named the first women for cabinet-level positions in his incoming administration. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is the country's U.N. ambassador, and charter schools advocate Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. Haley, the 44-year-old daughter of Indian immigrants, is serving her second term as governor. Farhan Haq is a U.N. spokesman and said he's aware of the selection.
And it's someone with whom officials here are acquainted in terms of being aware of her position on many issues, including laudable comments she made following the horrifying racist shootings in Charleston, South Carolina.
DeVos is chair of the American Federation for Children, a group that has sought to expand the number of charter schools and voucher programs in the U.S. to allow students to attend private schools with taxpayer money. The choices require Senate confirmation. In a video message released to coincide with the Thanksgiving holiday Thursday, Mr. Trump appealed for unity following a divisive election campaign.
It's my prayer that on this Thanksgiving, we begin to heal our divisions and move forward as one country, strengthened by shared purpose and very, very common resolve.
He called for a national campaign to rebuild the country and restore the full promise of America for all its people. Violence in Central African Republic over the past 2 days has left at least 16 dead and displaced thousands more. Clashes erupted this week in the town of Bria, northeast of the capital Bangui, between the militia of the Popular Front for the Renaissance of Central African Republic and the Union for Central African People. Both are breakaway factions of the Seleka Muslim Alliance that orchestrated the country's 2013 coup, ushering in a period of sectarian violence. This is VOA News. In northern Iraq, the tide of refugees fleeing the fighting between Iraqi-led forces and Islamic State defenders continues, amid reports that Shia paramilitary units are closing in on the IS-held town of Tal Afar between Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. Meanwhile, nearly 70,000 have fled the fighting in Mosul, the second-largest city in Iraq, where an anti-IS coalition is closing in from the east, north, and south. Iraqi forces are pushing deeper into the city from the east. Captain Asar Al-Kabi is with the Basra Battalion of the Iraqi Special Forces Operation.
Every day we have to push. Okay. Every day we are going to the front and ISIS going to the rear. And we will defeat them.
The Iraqi military estimates between 5 and 6,000 IS fighters face a combined Iraqi coalition force of some 100,000. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said Wednesday his country supports the Syrian regime against what he called extremists and that it's necessary for the stability of the region. In a position at odds with his country's financial backers in the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, which supports efforts to topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Jerusalem's municipality has proposed building hundreds more housing units in the Ramat Shlomo settlement north of the city, the first expansion plan announced since the November 8 election of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. Stephen Zunis is a regional analyst at the University of San Francisco.
Any additional Israeli settlements outside of that country's internationally recognized border is considered illegal under international law, and the United States has made clear that at minimum it is harmful to the peace process.
Palestinian lawmaker Mustafa Barghouti said the move is dangerous. A mini-budget released in Britain Wednesday indicates the departure from the European Union, backed by voters in a June referendum, will slow the economy and force the government to borrow heavily. Philip Hammond, Chancellor of the Exchequer, addressed the Parliament.
In view of the uncertainty facing the economy and in the face of slower growth forecasts, we no longer seek to deliver a surplus in 2019-20. But the Prime Minister and I, Mr. Speaker, remain firmly committed to seeing the public finances return to balance as soon as practicable, while leaving enough flexibility to support the economy in the near term.
Britain is expected to borrow as much as $152 billion in the period of 2021, with about half said to be linked to Britain's EU exit. A Rwandan Catholic priest wanted to return to his native country said Wednesday he was blocked from doing so. Thomas Nihimana, who left Rwanda 11 years ago over fear of his safety, was barred from boarding a connecting flight. He hopes to run an opposition party. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 24, Thanksgiving Day here in the United States. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A Sudan rebel group says it will stop recruiting children as soldiers.
The problem is not the number that the child, whether they are two or three, whatever number, that deserve not to be subjected to difficulties and combat areas. And I think that is a matter of principle, not a matter of number.
Malik Agha is the chairman of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, NOF. Meanwhile, the Khartoum government has welcomed the rebels' decision to end the use of child soldiers. The South Sudan government reacts to the latest Human Rights Watch report alleging killings and rape in Yale City. And a Swaziland workers' group wants an inquiry into alleged missing of public funds.
We want that investigation so that if indeed this money is missing, and we are saying that heads have to roll, because Swaziland cannot afford losses of such amounts.
Vincent Nkongwani is the Secretary General of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. Somali organizations help refugees rebuild their lives, and survivors provide clues to Ebola's lingering dangers in Liberia. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. One of four armed groups in Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, has agreed to end and prevent the recruitment and use of children in conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the group signed an action plan for carrying out the agreement.
To date, 59 armed groups and government forces are listed in the UN Secretary General's report on children and armed conflict as having committed grave violations against children. The violations include killing and maiming, attacks on schools and hospitals, sexual violence, recruitment, and abduction of children. By signing the action plan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North hopes to get itself off the list. The UN Special Representative for the Secretary General on Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zarugi, says the list is a kind of prod to armed groups.
One party to conflict is ready to cooperate, is ready to stop the violation. I would like to encourage them to stop the violation, move forward, rather than blaming them. If people don't act, then we name and shame.
Implementation of the action plan will begin as soon as the UN Children's Fund, which is the lead agency in this process, and its partners gain access to the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile State, where the SPLMN is located. UN aid agencies have not had access to those areas for about 5 years, a situation the SPLMN blames on the Sudanese government. Once the UN is able to reach the areas, Zarugi says aid workers will screen the troops to see how many children are in the ranks of the armed group. SPLMN Chairman Malik Agha tells VOA that a United Nations report in 2012 had listed 11 children as having been recruited, but a more recent report, he says, puts that number at 4.
The problem is not the number, whether it's 1 or 10, that's not the problem. The problem is the principle that the child, whether they are 2 or 3, whatever number, that deserve not to be subjected to hazards and his life subjected to difficulties and combat areas. And I think that is a matter of principle, not a matter of number.
UNICEF will oversee the demobilization and reintegration of the child soldiers into their local communities. The agency will trace the children's families and provide them with education and psychological care to help them cope with their trauma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The government of the Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir says it welcomes the decision by the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North rebel group to end the recruitment and use of child soldiers. The group has been fighting the Bashir government in Blue Nile and South Kordofan. The SPLN North signed an action plan Wednesday with the United Nations to end child recruitment and to release all child soldiers. Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says the news is especially welcoming because his government has in the past captured child soldiers who, he said, had been used by the rebels as human shields.
Actually, we are very happy to hear that because many times have been children involved in the rebel movement in Darfur and in the SPLA North. And we arrested actually many of the children and we released them and went to school. Now we are glad that they stopped this and they signed. And if it practically feel they didn't do this, it is a good thing actually. We appreciate that.
There's also the Justice and Equality Movement and the Sudan Liberation Army. They are also fighting your government. Do you think they also use children as soldiers?
Yes, they use children. And actually, we arrested more than 300 of the children and have been released by forgiveness by the president last summer. And also, when the attack on Durman, also we have arrested many children, actually, under 18. And they used to do this because now they couldn't recruit people, so they are being kidnapped children and they recruit them as soldiers.
Of course, Minister, the SPLM North had accused your government of using chemical weapons on civilians in Darfur.
This is a lie. This is a lie, a big lie. And we didn't actually have chemical weapons. We didn't use it at all since 1955. And because they have been defeated and they have no now grounds in Darfur, they are using this. They said before there is a massive fire. Rape, now they are saying about chemical weapons, and all these are lies. They know this. And you know, the enemy army, they said that they have 20,000 soldiers in Darfur. They never heard. Actually, they are moving on all Darfur. They have never heard or seen these chemical weapons. This is just a lie.
Minister, there's a story that said Wednesday your security forces arrested, I think, four opposition figures. Any reaction?
Actually, they have not been arrested. They have been called to the headquarters of the security. They inquired about certain things and they have been released. Nobody is detained from the, you know, the leftist party. We have actually arrested them when the subsidy decision taken. We arrested about 11 to 13 people and we are going to release them. But for these four, especially for which you have been mentioned their name, nobody is detained.
Your government has been facing some protest, particularly because you decided to increase the price of fuel, and now you have a doctor's strike. How are you dealing with those?
You know, the doctor's strike is quite limited. Now the strike is over, and this is not because of the subsidies, because of some situation in hospitals. Now there is no strike from the doctors. Hospitals are as usual, doing business as usual.
What about the increase in the price of fuel? People say that is hurting the ordinary person.
And of course, you know, whenever you increase the price, whenever you do this sort of subsidies, you find that it is actually, we call it actually a sour medicine. The people usually, they don't like it. And this is usual everywhere in the world. Now, things are normal in Sudan. No strikes, no demonstrations. Everything is going now. It's okay.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Human Rights Watch says both the South Sudan government and rebel forces have killed, raped, arbitrarily arrested, and abducted civilians in the city of Yei in the central Equatorial region, about 150 kilometers south of the capital, Juba. In its latest report, the group says attacks on civilians have intensified since July following fighting in and around Juba. But the report has been met with skepticism by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, SPLA. Army spokesman Lo Rual tells INBO he's not yet seen the report nor any evidence that crimes were committed by his soldiers against civilians.
I'm yet to see the report that they have released. However, I would like to make it very clear that this is not a new allegation. They have been accusing SPLA from time to time of alleged atrocities, and we have been challenging them to give us the evidence so that we could go against those who are involved in the reported atrocities. In the last 2 to 3 months, we have been reporting about atrocities that are being committed against civilians by rebels. So I'm surprised to hear that the government is being accused as well.
There are South Sudanese witnesses and South Sudanese victims themselves who have come forth and said, these are the crimes that have been committed against me and my family. Do their voices not matter?
Their voices do matter. But of course, without us hearing from them so that we go against their abuses, it would be difficult for us to take the accusation at face value.
What attempts has the government made to hear some of the voices of the victims who are crying and saying that their own government is attacking them?
In July, in Wau, some SPLA soldiers were accused of having killed a couple. When we did our investigation, we found out that they did just that. We took very drastic measures against them. We also did the same to SPLA soldiers who were accused of having committed illegal acts against our civilians in Juba. We sentenced some of our own soldiers to death by firing squad. We dismissed some from military service, and we sentenced some to long-term prison sentences. These were the steps we took after establishing that indeed some of our own servicemen took part in committing atrocities.
Among the soldiers of the SPLA, what is the protocol of acting with civilians? Because again, as this report points out, it seems as if there is a trend of violence targeting civilians.
I would say no. I don't concur with that finding or with that conclusion. What we have been saying is that, yes, from time to time we heard reports from our servicemen being accused of doing this and that, and the serious accusations we heard were in Wau, like I said earlier on, and in Juba here. And we took good steps meant at ensuring that civilians are not targeted by SPLA soldiers. We took some good steps, and the steps are still, the preventive mechanisms we put in place are still in place, and they have not been violated since July. What we are saying is there are violations by SPLA soldiers, and those who are having the evidence of them, let them come forward. There is no trend from our side. There were isolated cases here and there, and those cases were sufficiently addressed.
Lou Rual is a spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army. He was speaking from Juba, South Sudan, with Ian Bio of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 24th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, TOKUSWA, is threatening what it calls a national shutdown if Prime Minister Barnabas Dlamini fails to launch an independent investigation into alleged missing public funds from the Treasury Department bank accounts. This after an independent forensic audit of the Accountant General's office showed a $360 million shortfall in the Treasury Department bank accounts. Vincent Nkongwa, Secretary General of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, says workers are planning to meet soon to decide the dates of the protests against the alleged financial malfeasance.
We want that investigation so that the veracity of that can be determined. So that if indeed this money is missing, and we are saying that heads have to roll, because Swaziland cannot afford losses of such amounts. And we need to know whether these amounts, if they are indeed lost, are not a result of corruption. So this is what we want to get.
We heard TOKUSWA is threatening to have a national shutdown if the Prime Minister Dlamini fails to ensure an independent investigation into this alleged missing funds. What do you mean by a national shutdown?
Our affiliates are currently discussing with their own members, the workers. Because if this money is indeed missing, then we begin to wonder what it could have done had it been properly spent. With the extent of need in the country, it is clear that this money could have done a lot. So we may have to call for serious protest action to push the government towards this inquiry that we are talking about. Because if left unchecked, so there can easily be more scandals.
What has been the reaction of Swazis when this information came out that a huge amount of money ranging to several millions of dollars have been lost from the public treasury?
There is widespread concern to the extent that a good number of even organizations have given us the support that they are also supporting our call for an independent inquiry. So we would hope that government is going to take this very, very seriously, because it's something that we cannot just let go.
Some Swazis are saying that international donors who support the government should threaten to withhold donor support if the government fails to investigate and to ascertain where those funds have gotten and to prosecute those who are involved in mismanaging the funds or, for that matter, embezzling the funds. What do you say to that?
We are concerned where the international community looks the other way when there are issues of financial mismanagement in the country. I will give an example. Sometime in July, we had some members of the royal family coming to Los Angeles on a junket. Well, this is the type of wasteful expenditure that you are saying the international community cannot afford to keep quiet. Because if they do so, then the government is not going to see how serious is it that we cannot have monies to be thrown up just like that.
So far, what has been the response of Prime Minister Dlamini's government or officials of the government concerning this?
He has been silent, and the COSLA will be having a meeting in the next 2 weeks where we are then going to take decisive action.
When do you plan officially sending a petition, or will the petition be presented when you decide to go on a national strike or demonstration or protest for that matter?
Yes, as I say, in about 2 weeks, that is when the Federation will have done its work in terms of sensitizing and mobilizing the workers. So we'll see how we take it from there.
Are you not concerned that you could be banned again if you go ahead with this protest or demonstrations against the government?
We think that the action such as that was taken by the United States as regards to the AGOA eligibility, those are steps that ensure that government is kept in check. So we think that government will not act that negligently to ban us. Of course, they will try to intimidate. Of course, they will try to harass, as they normally do. But we are not going to back off because of that.
Vincent Nkongwani is the Secretary General of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte from the capital, Mbabane. As more refugees return to Somalia, authorities are concerned that lack of opportunities could make them vulnerable to recruitment by the militant group Al-Shabaab. To counter the threat, the American Refugee Council is offering training to young people to rebuild their lives. Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Somali port city of Kismayo.
A class in progress. Abdullahi Mohammed is learning how to fix a car engine. Mohammed, who doesn't want his face shown on camera, is one of the returnees from the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. He says he wants to leave refugee life behind.
I hope that very soon I'll be able to be independent, help myself and other returnees. I want to leave the refugee status behind me and become independent.
Dozens of students are learning skills to better their lives after years in the refugee camp, which the Kenyan government plans to close next year. Their training is sponsored by a private organization, the American Refugee Council. ARC works with different business owners in Kismayo to help provide training to the youth for at least 3 months. A short drive from this garage, another group of returnees is learning how to make window frames. Most of them have been here for 3 months. One of them, Shafi Ali, says he wants to help himself and others.
When I complete my training at this center, I would like to have my own workshop and also to help by teaching the skills to the young people who are returning to the country from Dadaab.
34,000 Somalis have returned from Dadaab in recent months, with 18,000 coming to Kismayo. Many are struggling for lack of resources, and authorities fear Islamist militants will try to exploit the situation.
Some of the youths who are returning are high school graduates. With the science knowledge they have, Al-Shabaab may take advantage of them and use them and teach them how to make explosives. Young people are vulnerable. If they are not provided with the skills, education, and materials they need to pursue their goals, then people will take advantage of them.
The organizers of this training program hope their students, armed with the means to make a living, will only want to help themselves and Somali society. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Kismayo, Somalia.
The Ebola epidemic in West Africa was unprecedented. Never before had an outbreak of the virus infected so many people in the same period of time. Researchers in Liberia are now studying Ebola survivors and their partners to investigate the long-term health impact of the virus and the possibility of future transmission. Jennifer Lazute has the story from Monrovia.
Patrick S. Folly emerged from an Ebola treatment unit on October 13, 2014, 2 weeks after testing positive for the virus. It is a day, he says, he will never forget. The joy and relief of knowing he had survived quickly turned to sorrow when he arrived home to discover his mother, who had cared for him when they thought he had malaria, and his 8-month-old son, who hugged Folly before he went to the hospital, had died.
God, whom you cannot see where my mom was. I got home, you cannot see where my son was. That's so difficult. Love him so much, and love all of my family. And to see my family, they are no more united, and there are some fragments, some portion of the family have been taken away by EVD virus. It's been terrible for me.
Folly, who is now the president of the National Ebola Survivors Network in Liberia, is one of more than 10,000 Ebola survivors in West Africa. The group is helping researchers learn more about how the disease works. Masuka Fala is the principal investigator of the Ebola Natural History Study in Monrovia.
On the largest cohort of study with global implications, looking just on understanding virus as a whole, virus persistence as a whole, we want to understand exactly why some people succumb to the diseases and why some people die. We're also trying to understand the biology of protection. Why is it some survivors have some manifestation compared to others?
One of the top concerns is survivor transmission. The World Health Organization says that male Ebola survivors have passed on the virus to sexual partners as long as a year after being declared cured of the disease. Previously, it was thought the window for transmission was just 90 days. A sub-study of the Monrovia Project will follow 120 male survivors for 6 months to see if a drug called GS5734 can eliminate or reduce the amount of Ebola virus that persists in their semen. Another key area of interest is female survivors, who then become pregnant. The virus remains present in some bodily fluids, raising the question of whether or not a mother can pass the virus to her child, before or during birth, as well as after birth when breastfeeding.
We have not seen any case of in utero transmission of a new virus case from the mother to the child in the mother's womb. What we probably have seen in our initial studies is that there can be maternally acquired antibodies. We clearly can show that from our studies that they acquire maternal antibodies from the mothers. And then one study we're doing right now at the 6 months and 9 months, we're trying to get the blood of the babies and see how long does that maternally acquired antibody last.
Such research, he said, will not only help to better understand Ebola, but also other hemorrhagic diseases such as Lassa fever. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Monrovia.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Fighting between rival militia groups in the Central African Republic has killed 16 people and driven thousands of civilians from their homes, the UN peacekeeper said on Wednesday. The latest clashes between two former factions, the Popular Front for the Renaissance of the Central African Republic and the Union for Peace in Central Africa of the Seleka rebel group, broke out Monday in the town of Bria. A United Nations peacekeeping base was targeted before the blue helmets drove the gunmen away. That's it for this Thursday, November 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte saying, have a lovely Thursday.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clarty, host of the VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.